Hello, Gallatin Valley and online listeners. You are listening to KGVM Bozeman Community Radio, broadcasting at 95.9 FM and streaming at kgvm.org. I'm Roxana, and this is Desert Oracle Radio Replay. It is a warm April day as I record this. You might hear my neighbors hauling their trailers on our old logging roads right now in the background. I'm going to be leaving for the desert soon for a couple weeks, and so for the rest of April, we're going to have double features for you, and that includes today. First up is a fresh episode from Ken Lane, produced April 12th, 2024. He calls it Standing with the Giants at Mariposa Grove. And it includes a little discussion towards the end about sacred groves. Enjoy.
Desert Oracle Radio, the voice of the desert.
Dear Mrs. Carr, I have from time to time heard from you through some of our mutual friends from Pasadena who have visited Yosemite. I have not seen a copy of Mr. Muir's book, nor heard before that it was published. If he dedicated it to anyone, it should have been to you, as no one person has given to him the great encouragement and assistance which you have. I have not seen him but once since he was married. He then looked more careworn and not so happy as he used to be when engaged in his excursions within and studies of nature's wonderful works in the Sierra Nevada mountains. From a letter of reply by Galen Clark, December 3rd, 1894, handwritten beneath the letterhead, Yosemite Valley and Mariposa Big Tree Grove, Guardian's Office, Galen Clark, Guardian. Alongside the Seal of Minerva, State of California. Mariposa Grove, the largest stand of sequoias within Yosemite National Park, was maintained as a sacred site by American Indians for more than 3,000 years. That's an educated guess by tribal elders and anthropologists, and coincidentally, the approximate age of some of the grove's most ancient trees, 3,000 years. That's the estimated age of the famed grizzly giant, standing tall at 209 feet, It might be 2,700 years old, and it might be 3,200 years old. No real way to count. As long as it lives, as long as it stands. The British-Canadian conservationist Galen Clark, along with his comrade Milton Mann, are said to be the first Europeans to see the grove, having set out to rediscover it after finding other sequoia giants in the vicinity. Galen Clark became a crucial advocate for the protection of these Sierra treasures. On June 30, 1864, as the war entered its fourth and final bloody year, Abraham Lincoln signed the legislation creating the Yosemite Valley and Mariposa Grove Nature Preserve, the first time in history a federal government protected natural and scenic landscapes for public enjoyment. Galen Clark became the grove's very first ranger serving as guardian of the Yosemite Grant for a quarter century. Like his friend and fellow Sierra Club charter member John Muir, Clark heralded the spiritual power of Yosemite's ancient forests. For Galen Clark, this land became his home and his calling for the rest of his long life. The power and magnificence of the Yosemite lands inspired Clark to advocate for the protection and preservation of these ancient groves and the geologic wonderland of Yosemite Valley. In the early 21st century, it has become popular to demonize the people of earlier times and to dismiss their life's work. Because such people of previous centuries did not live in exactly the same ways as the computer-dependent inmates of the modern police state. And yet without the Galen Clarks of our past, what remains of the ancient groves would now be gone. Stumps of 100 feet in diameter in weed-choked ravines of pillaged earth. On this radio program, we try not to do that. We don't dismiss the life's work of Minerva Hamilton Hoyt, mother of Joshua Tree National Park and Death Valley National Park and Anza-Borrego Desert State Park and even Mexico's first desert national parks. Because she was a rich person from the Deep South in the Jim Crow era. We do not throw John Muir's legacy in the garbage because he did not know 21st century corporate greenwashing names for California Indians. Night has fallen on the desert, and tonight I want to tell you a story from old times. An era that would be unrecognizable to most of us. It was just a half dozen years after the gold rush, when people from around the world were flocking to the mythical land called California. California, a romantic and mysterious name, its etymology still argued. The root has many possible sources, but only two have stood up to the scrutiny of the past century and a half. And both of those derive from literary works. The great Norman French epic Song of Roland from 1,000 years ago. And a Spanish novel first published 514 years ago in the year of 1510. The Adventures of Esplandian. The Song of Roland is a poetic telling of a real battle in the Pyrenees centuries earlier and credited to the Norman poet Taroldus. The adventure novel, the Spanish one, was written by Garcia Rodriguez de Montalvo, who described the island of California like this. Know then that on the right hand of the Andes, there is an island called California, very close to the side of the terrestrial paradise. And it was peopled by black women without any man among them, or they lived in the fashion of Amazons. They were of strong and hardy bodies, of ardent courage and great force. Their island was the strongest in all the world, with its steep cliffs and rocky shores. Their weapons and armor were all of gold, and so was the harness of the wild beasts which they tamed and rode. For in the whole island, there was no metal but gold. Khalifa is the Spanish version of Khalifa, the Arabic word. Caliph, ruler of the realm. Khalifia would be, by this logic, the female leader of this island kingdom. The real California, long thought to be an island too, was a new American state when the gold rush hit. Just in time. Galen Clark was a pioneer who first settled in Missouri with his wife and children. But after his wife died young, he found his way to the Sierra. Hoping for gold, he instead found work as a laborer. But when his lungs went bad, he decided to build a log cabin and wait out his fate in the beautiful mountains. Tuberculosis usually meant death in those days before antibiotics. Those days before antibiotics were so common and widely used that our dairy cows are fed chicken excrement as a cheap source of calories and leftover chicken antibiotics.
Desert Oracle Radio.
Anyway, there was Galen Clark, 43 years old, a widower, dead broke, and marked for death. As he wrote later, I went to the mountains to take my chances of dying or growing better, which I thought were about even. It turns out he had another 50 years ahead of him, and his life's mission soon became clear. Let's now quote from the National Park Service's biography of Clark. Born in Shipton, Canada East, now Quebec, in 1814, Clark developed a passion for Yosemite when he first visited the area in 1855 as part of a 17-member pioneer tourist party. After suffering a lung hemorrhage and quitting his job as a packer at the Mariposa Ditch Company, he decided to either find a cure or end his days in the mountain air. Settling at the meadowlands of Wawona in 1857, Clark built a log cabin near a river ford and trail that provided access to both the Mariposa Grove of Big Trees and Yosemite Valley. The road from Wawona, an Indian word believed to mean big tree, was considered the most scenic since it included the famed view of Old Inspiration Point. Clark's rest stop, soon known as Clark Station, furnished visitors with meals, shelter, and a place to graze their horses. There, Clark engaged his guests on a variety of topics from fauna and flora to American Indian history and geology. Within 5 years, Clark ascended to a critical role in the development of what would eventually become Yosemite National Park. In 1864, President Abraham Lincoln signed the Act of Congress transferring Yosemite Valley and the Mariposa Grove to the state of California as a grant reserved from settlement. Terms of the act required that the state shall accept the grant upon the express conditions that the premises shall be held for public use, resort and recreation, and shall be inalienable for all time. The grant was locally administered by a guardian representing an 8-man board of commissioners. Their first choice for the new position was Galen Clark. Throughout the next 24 years, commissioners came and went, but the popular and effective Clark was retained as guardian. However, as a businessman, he proved less successful. To keep his stage stop at Wawona afloat, he was compelled to borrow money, take out mortgages. Unable to clear the debt, he sold out to the road-building Washburn Brothers in 1874. The site was eventually developed into the Wawona Hotel Complex that continues to serve Yosemite visitors today. Despite failing as a businessman, Clark never lost his reputation for hospitality and generosity to weary travelers. Quote, he kindly furnished us with flour and a little sugar and tea, My companion, who complained of the benumbing poverty of a strictly vegetarian diet, gladly accepted Mr. Clark's offer of a piece of bear that had just been killed. John Muir wrote that in The Yosemite. On Muir's very first visit to Yosemite, he met Clark at Wawona. Over the years, the two outdoorsmen made many wilderness sojourns together, in which Clark scrambled through thick chaparral in the easiest way. Deemed the best mountaineer that Muir ever met, Clark sought few comforts when outdoors. He was even careless about selecting a bed for the night. Wrote Muir, he would lie down anywhere on any ground, rough or smooth, without taking pains even to remove cobbles or sharp-angled rocks protruding through the grass or gravel. Clark accompanied Ralph Waldo Emerson, along with Muir, during the Great Transcendentalist's 1871 visit to the Mariposa Grove. Clark proudly pointed out a lower branch on the grizzly giant sequoia that was 6 feet, 7 inches in diameter. As big as the base of any tree trunk Emerson might have seen in New England. In 1880, changes in state politics temporarily ended Clark's guardianship. A new state constitution brought in a new board of commissioners who promptly replaced him with James Hutchings. After 9 tumultuous years and 3 guardian failures, 75-year-old Clark was reappointed to his old post in 1889. Finally, in 1897, conceding that a younger man was needed for the job, he officially retired. But even in retirement, Clark kept busy in Yosemite, working as a tourist camp manager and guide. On March 24, 1910, a few days before his 96th birthday, Clark died at his daughter's home in Oakland, California. Decades earlier, he had chosen his final resting place not far from Yosemite Falls. He had dug his own grave, planted seedlings from the Mariposa Grove sequoias, and selected a granite marker. Today, visitors can stand at Galen Clark's gravesite in the Valley Cemetery and marvel at the growth of those sequoias amidst the expanse of his conservation efforts. That same National Park Service page has links to 3 of Galen Clark's books on Yosemite, all on the American Library's Internet Archive. And I'll link that on the Desert Oracle Radio blog, or you can look it up later. NPS.gov, Galen Clark. I want to say hello and thanks to Patty in Silver City. She was kind enough to send a nice note and a check to help support the operation out here, such as it is. And I'm so far behind in reading and even opening the good mail that it took me a couple of months to see her letter and cash the check. How many stacks of evil and worthless mail must a person deal with in this life? I've got the bills due stack, the tax notices that never make much sense, so I just do whatever it says. The various things I have to fight, such as bills from crooked doctors and crooked insurance companies. And the sequoia-sized stacks of junk mail full of every personal detail and business detail. And all of that must be taken to the copy shop and shredded, a service for which I am charged by the pound. And happier news, We are listening to new soundscapes composed and performed by Red, Blue, Black, Silver. I want to tell you something that not a lot of people know, so don't let it get around. Outside the circle, you know? It has been my intention for the past decade and a half or so to remove myself from the busy work, always online, never-ending crisis of modern life. To live out the remaining time I'm allotted in the wilderness. Night and day, week in and week out. Doing work that satisfies my soul and does some good. And as Ringo Starr sang, it don't come easy. Yeah, I know George Harrison wrote the song. Desert Oracle was conceived to be entirely within the wilderness realm. A decade ago, I was led to a forest of centuries-old pinyon pines at the northern prominence of a relatively small mountain range, nestled between the immense White Mountains and Sierra Nevada. Led by what? By whom? It's not important to attach a name to such forces. They are real enough. I have never needed to convince myself of the power of a primal forest, of a dramatic outcropping of granite, of the soul within a mountain lion. In the wild places, it's easy to talk to the gods. It comes easy. Sometimes out loud, sometimes in song and verse, but more often, I listen for them. They are in the breeze, rustling through the branches, the cheerful chattering of the pinyon jays, the beautiful song of the coyote at just the right moment. The Santa Minerva Sacred Grove is a real place, and this summer I'm going to do some campfire stories there. And introduce some of you to this place that will be preserved as not just a nature refuge or a place for human enjoyment, but as a sacred grove in the ancient and modern sense. After all, there are plenty of places for rock climbing, for rock mining, for hunting and fishing, for human recreation, for turning the centuries-old trees into biofuel or toilet paper. A sacred grove is not such a place. As it says on the Santa Minerva website, and by the way, that just means sacred wisdom, holy wisdom, etc. Sacred groves and forests are protected for their spiritual and ecological importance. Such groves are found today throughout India, home of more than a million holy forests. Japan, many thousands of guardian forests surrounding Shinto temples. And Ethiopia, 35,000 primal forests circling Ethiopian Orthodox churches. Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia protect and revere the last of the pre-Christian sacred forests of the Baltic region. And Nigeria, Poland, Ghana, Turkey, Syria, Italy, Australia, Guyana, and Nepal are some of the modern-day nations where people have also preserved some of their ancient sacred landscapes. Sacred groves protect many rare, threatened, and endemic species of plants and animals and are often the last stand of ancient forest in a community or bioregion. Biodiversity thrives within these sanctified nature preserves, while festivals dating back to antiquity and beyond provide people with a deep and lasting connection to their culture, religious practices, folklore, and history. Sacred groves turn up wherever you look for them. The Old Testament is full of such natural shrines and holy mountains. All of the religions of Abraham began with his pilgrimage to the famed Oracle Oak, the Oak of Morah in Canaan. Morah means teacher, oracle, a word left untranslated in our modern Bibles. The Buddha was born in a sacred grove, the sacred grove of Lumbini, 2,600 years ago. Excavations at the site in 2013 revealed a timber structure that, quote, appears to be an ancient tree shrine. Speak of such things again, along with our usual ghost stories and historical tales and strange folklore. All these deep veins of meaning within the land we love. Love it or leave it. Leave it to the developers and resource pillagers. In the weeks to come, I'll let you know more about the summer campfire sessions when the weather up there is like springtime in the Mojave, just beautiful. The last weekend of July, when plenty of you will be up there already in the earthly paradise, the heart of the breathtakingly beautiful Eastern Sierra, the Owens River, Mono Lake, the John Muir and Ansel Adams Wilderness, Tuolumne Meadows, Bishop and Lee Vining, the Holy Land. I want you to visit the sacred grove. I want you to think about having such places in your life. I want you to come to our summer campfire stories and seasonal festivals and consult the real oracle of the Whispering Pines. It has never failed me so far. I'm still wound up from being there in January. So I'll leave you with this tonight. A radically different bottom-up conservation strategy is gaining ground worldwide. About 40% of the Earth's wildlife-rich forests are still defended by the local groups who live in and around them. Empowering such ecosystem people, who live close to nature and can directly observe and appreciate the manifold benefits it confers, could be the most effective way to protect what remains of the planet's biodiversity. That's from an article by the biologist Madhav Godgil in Scientific American. Sacred Forest in Scientific American. Good night from the Voice of the Desert.
We are at the bottom of the hour, and you are listening to Desert Oracle Radio Replay on KGVM 95.9 FM, Bozeman Community Radio. Our second episode today was released by Ken Lane on April 19th, 2019. It's called Redacted by the Aliens. Don't be scared.
Transmitting from the Mojave Wilderness in Joshua Tree, California, now is the time for Desert Oracle Radio, the voice of the desert.
This is Anna.
Hello, Anna. This is Ken.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. How are you?
I'm good. Let me put on headphones. The sound will be a little bit better, unless
All right.
You want the sound to be bad. One sec. Okay, how's that?
Let's see. I think that's going to be good.
Okay, great.
Do you have your book there?
Yeah, I have a PDF of it, which is easy to search.
Okay. Will you read, like, a paragraph so I can get a level on you?
Sure. According to Good, the non-terrestrial beings started showing up at trainings early on. Most of us had weird memories or dreams, Good says, prior dreams of pirate ships coming to pick the children up and taking them away to a strange place. It turns out we were being introduced before the program to non-terrestrials. In the VR simulations, Good says, they would see gray aliens sitting quietly at a table. How's that?
That's good. Can you do one more?
Yes, totally. There were also hybrid children present at Carswell, he adds, meaning part human, part alien. At night, he would be taken to meet with cells, as he puts it, of 90 to 120 other children to continue their training in dark-closed indoor malls.
He's been to outer space.
He's been to outer space.
How is it out there?
I think he would tell you that he was so busy fighting the hostile aliens that he didn't have much time to appreciate the majesty of space.
Yeah, the natural beauty is...
Right. It's like any job. You kind of get sucked into what you're doing. You don't have time to take a look around.
All right, so we have established that whatever pronunciation I found for your name... that I think was some host introducing a panel was wrong.
Yeah, it's Merlin.
It's not Merlin.
No, it's Merlin. Merlin, I feel like Merlin is a much, actually, more straightforward pronunciation because it's, you know, the wizard. But I think people don't want to believe my name is Merlin because it's just ridiculous.
We are, and I'll do an intro. That's...
Okay.
We have Anna Merlin on the line. And is it Conspiracy of Lies? Is that correct?
It's called Republic of Lies.
Republic of Lies. Jesus Christ. And now something is literally... Was that your phone that...
Oh, yeah. Sorry. That was my computer. Let me turn the audio all the way down on my computer. There we go. Now we're fine. Okay. Sorry about that.
That's fine. I thought it was mine. I was about to throw another piece of equipment across the room.
No, we're doing great. We're real well over here.
We have... Anna Merlin on the line to talk about her just published new book, Republic of Lies. Anna, welcome to Desert Oracle Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Now, we have a long list of things to possibly cover here. So before we jump into those, can you tell us like the little 30-second, 90-second summary of your book?
Yeah. The book is broadly just kind of a survey of conspiratorial ideas in America and trying to understand how we got to a place where somebody who promotes so many conspiracy theories could be the president. It's also kind of a sympathetic read of conspiracy theories. It talks about why they are important to people and also why a country with so many actual conspiracies tends to be host to a lot of conspiracy theorists as well.
And some of the conspiracies and the cultures around them that...
Mm-hmm.
Something just started beeping. What the hell? I think it must be in the line. There's nothing... I don't see anything showing up.
That's really weird.
Let's see... So can you tell us some of the conspiracies and the conspiracy cultures that you covered in this book?
So I hung out with some anti-vax vaccine folks. I attended a trial of a couple I know who are redemption theorists, which is a branch of sovereign citizenry. I went to a MUFON conference, which is the Mutual UFO Network, which I think we'll probably talk more about. I went to a white supremacist rally and talked about sort of like white racist conspiracy theories, though not in as much depth as I could. I went to a New Age expo called Conscious Life and talked a little bit about the sort of overlap of New Age and conspiratorial thinking. So yeah, it was a real long 2 years doing this.
Now, I've only ever seen you in person at random parties when you've been working on this book.
We keep running into each other at these really strange parties that neither of us are supposed to be at. Or, well, no, wait. I crashed a party that you were invited to that I didn't realize was a party. And then we both ended up at a weird party that I was not invited to, but I assume you were. So actually, the theme here is that I keep crashing parties that you are legitimately attending.
I think so. I think, but you were at the LA Times Books Festival, weren't you?
I was.
And this party, I thought, was an LA Times Books Festival party, but somehow
it wasn't.
Oh, it wasn't? Good
no.
Lord. All right.
Do you just show up where they tell you without a...
Sometimes. I know that it was for Alta Journal because they had featured Desert Oracle in 2 issues in a row. So I guess so my prize was I got invited to the party, I guess. And when I saw you at this Joshua Tree party across the street from my office, I think you were coming back from a UFO convention in Nevada in the suburbs of Las Vegas. Was that the MUFON convention?
Yeah, that was MUFON. It was MUFON 2017, and it was in Summerlin, Nevada. And that was actually a very sort of dramatic MUFON convention. So I feel lucky that I got to attend that specific one. It was full of intrigue and controversy and factionalism, which I enjoyed a great deal.
Most of our listeners will know about MUFON, but it started off as the Midwest UFO Network, I believe, in the 1950s or 60s.
Mm-hmm.
It's a strange organization because it used to be all about taking reports from people and investigating the more interesting UFO experiences that people had claimed to have. And you were there when all this stuff was going on. So give us a little rundown of what happened there and the kind of people who were there.
So I was there the year that the theme of MUFON was the search for the secret space program, or revealing the secret space program, which is a really controversial idea, and featured a bunch of speakers who basically claimed to be whistleblowers, like shining light on all these sort of secret government activities having to do with going to space. And it was kind of so MUFON likes to present itself obviously as like a scientific organization, and for a long time they were focused on, as you said, taking reports of UFO sightings, and also at their conferences, featuring talks from people who were talking a lot about spacecraft themselves. They focused on the work of people like Bob Lazar, who were trying to reverse engineer. Bob Lazar obviously claims that he worked at a subsection of Area 51 trying to reverse engineer a spacecraft. So MUFON at this 2017 convention kind of moved away from all of that and started featuring the accounts of guys like Corey Good, who is a person who claims to have been enlisted in a secret space program, fighting, you know, hostile aliens for 20 years out in space, and that at the end of his military service, the government performed an age regression on him, and he woke up in his bed as a child again. He has a pretty sort of healthy presence on the sort of New Age lecture circuit, and he now, in the past 2 years, has also said that he has, like, ongoing contacts with an inner Earth civilization called the Anshar. And that he essentially, I think his claim now is that he also sits on like a galactic council, and that he's part of like the conduit between, you know, these advanced alien civilizations and humanity, essentially.
Did he continue growing after they turned him back into a child, or is he still a child?
No, he looks like a normal guy.
So he's aged since then?
He's aged plenty.
Why is MUFON involved in this? MUFON is supposed to be involved in investigating the phenomena of anomalous aerial vehicles. Why are they bringing him around?
I mean, I would hate to be cynical, but I'm about to be, which is that the MUFON higher-ups that I talked to at the conference acknowledged that this was a controversial step for the organization, that some people had quit, you know, who were involved in the organization or renounced their membership and said, this isn't what I signed up for. But also, it brought in a lot of new blood. It was probably pretty good for ticket sales. So I would say that they're kind of going in the direction that the UFO subculture is going, you know, which is that there is much more of a focus on individual claims and people making claims that are really a lot more colorful. You know, one of the people that I saw speak was Andrew Basiago, who claims to have gone to Mars with a young Barack Obama via a space elevator created by the CIA.
Yes.
And just to make it better, he also says that at that point, Barack Obama's name was Barry Sotero, which is a birther conspiracy theory. The claim that Barack Obama's real name is Barry Sotero, like, that's directly where that comes from. One thing that I thought about a lot is that in every sort of conspiracy subculture, at some point, people show up claiming to be whistleblowers. It is a way to make yourselves indispensable to this discussion and have people invite you onto their TV show. There are a lot that are even weirder than this. One I think of all the time is this guy Mike Warnicki. He was like an American evangelist. Jesse Walker writes about him in his book, United States of Paranoia. But Mike Warnicki, for a while, started claiming that he was a former warlock. He had been part of satanic cult warlock situation, and that he was coming out of the satanic subculture to tell evangelical audiences about it. The one thing that I would say about Corey Good, for instance, is that the claims that he's making are super wild, you know, all the inner earth civilizations. He also claims that there's a lot of pedophilia and like sex cult stuff among NASA employees, which
sure.
I don't find, sure, as you do. But a lot of what he has to say is very sort of broadly new age. Most of the aliens just want us to live better lives and evolve to a higher state of being and be good to one another. So in the scope of people that I heard talking, he gave me less cause for concern.
Not. We were at that time talking with Joe Rogan. It's pretty amazing, but there is breaking news right now.
Oh, you got breaking UFO news? All right, these people want to hear it. I want to hear it. Go ahead.
Yeah, the breaking news is lieutenant in the police department in Savannah, Georgia, that did the Freedom of Information Act request and got the reports from the federal raid, the five agency raids that occurred on Balthazar when I was filming with him, that everybody said I was making up for the movie. And in fact, we have the report, and they were not looking for what they said they were looking for. This is the opinion of a lieutenant who is a career officer who talked in TED Talks about being a police officer. And he said, this is the craziest thing I've ever seen. They were not looking for a receipt. They were looking for a material, which just backs up and verifies what it is that we suspect about Bob Lazar.
All right. So they went to get alien stuff from Bob Lazar. Is that what you're saying?
What I'm saying is we don't know, but we do know it's a highly irregular raid on Bob's life during the filming of my show, of my movie.
And for the first time now, we have absolute proof
of the raid, which people actually questioned. They questioned if I made it up for the film. Now we have absolute proof of the federal raid. He said this is highly unusual, and they were not looking for a receipt. They were obviously looking for material. And so, you know, people can make what they want of that, but we're one step closer to the truth.
History ties in with white supremacist stuff, but it is absolutely a thing. Just to take Hollow Earth as an example, the idea of a Hollow Earth grew out of 19th century occult beliefs, and after World War II became the supposed site of Nazi scientists working on like secret spacecrafts, right?
And there's truth to that, right? Because the Nazis did have a rocket program that was close to leaving Earth, and we in the United States took the whole program, packed it up, and brought it to Texas.
But at the same time, there's all this mythology around it too. All these ideas that the Nazis were on the cusp of or had discovered things like time travel. Then white supremacist groups take it and use it as a way to talk about how Hitler was part of a race of advanced beings.
Ascended masters.
Yeah, that Hitler was an ascended master. Exactly.
Is there an explicit connection that some of these New Agers make with that, or is it implied?
I feel like it's more implied. My experience generally is that the Nazis and white supremacists who are into UFO stuff make explicit connections, but the UFO world, it is less explicit and more implied. Shows like Ancient Aliens will periodically have people on who are either ex-Nazis, race scientists, people who are promoting these really crazy alternative beliefs without drawing a direct line between their racist beliefs and their interest in UFOs.
UFOs, we don't have 10 hours, so we've all seen odd things in the sky. One of the best reported things that we've seen in the sky by people who should know better was over the Albertsons in Rosemont, right outside the West Gate of Edwards Air Force Base, where in April of 1997, busy parking lot after work, sun was down, dusk. All these people saw a huge rectangular or triangular black shape hovering silently over the Albertsons. So you don't necessarily have to go to the spookiest part of the desert to see something weird. It might be right there in the mini mall. That remains unexplained. As of yet, Skunk Works has yet to produce supermarket-sized, silent, hovering, useless black ships. But the defense budget is high, so we can't be completely sure. Anybody else before we run out? Yes.
Have you heard anything recently about any alien activity at Giant Rock?
Well, sadly, the main thing I hear about Giant Rock is people who go there and complain to me as if I did it, that the rock broke. So, I don't have anything. The most interesting stories I've found about Giant Rock are in declassified Cold War government documents that showed that both U.S. intelligence and Russian intelligence swarmed these UFO conferences that Van Tassel held that would have 5,000 to 10,000 people. And the idea, apparently much like Facebook today, was to go around and freak people out, make them scared of things, you know, break the fabric of society, etc. So, I have not heard, have you heard anything new from Giant Rock?
Wishful thinking.
Wishful thinking.
We have been talking about conspiracy tonight. The conspiracies that are sometimes true. Sometimes true, sometimes false, sometimes a little bit of fun. And sometimes the corrosive acid that breaks down an entire society. And I had some more examples, but they've all been redacted. But the sort of corrosive insanity that leads to stuff like the Nazis and Columbine and Pizzagate. Well, that's some weird and ugly stuff. Pizzagate. What a stupid time to be alive. That's a pretty good time, too. Because it is the only time we were given. The book we were talking about tonight is Republic of Lies by Anna Merlin. It's got a great cover, too. It's one of those covers that just jumps out at you. Like when you were a kid and you were kind of idling around the little bookstore in the mall or wherever. And something like Naked Lunch pops out at you, and oh boy. Or Communion. Which wasn't much of a book, but that cover was something. I used to live in this haunted old apartment in Eastern Europe. People were coming and going all the time, leaving things, taking things. Nobody had phones, so people had to learn to read books. And there were always books. One of these books was Communion, and I would not stand for that book's cover to be facing me at any time I was in that apartment. Leave, and then somebody would flip it over, and I'd come back late at night, and there it was, looking at me. That insect alien with those terrible eyes. Staring right into my soul. Anyway, the book is called Republic of Lies. Played for you a little bit of the presentation out at the Old Schoolhouse Museum in 29 Palms with the Desert Institute a little while back. It is nighttime and we have been in the desert together. Just you and me. You and me and them. The others. Saturday night, April 27th, join us at the Joshua Tree Astronomy Arts Theater. That's in North JT, next to Joshua Lakes Campground. And I will be there with our own Red, Blue, Black, Silver, who makes most of the soundscapes you hear on this program. And the director, Jeremy Corbell, will be there with a screening of his increasingly weird documentary about Bob Lazar, Area 51, and flying saucers. Increasingly weird because it's causing a lot of trouble. It's making people nervous. It starts at 6 p.m., 6 p.m. to 10 p.m. on Saturday, April 27. You can get advance tickets at redblueblacksilver.com or get tickets at the door, though it might be standing room only at that point. But we've got plenty of room for you. It looks like the lair of a villain from Spectre. And to our very patient subscribers, you should be seeing the new Desert Oracle Field Guide in your mailboxes in the next week or so. Finally, I know. You can find out more about what we're doing at desertoracle.com or send us something nice by the U.S. mail. We're at P.O. Box 1735 in Joshua Tree. And that's it for Desert Oracle Radio tonight. I am your host, Ken Lane, from Amboy to Zizix and across the great Mojave Wilderness and everywhere on the planet, thanks to the mundane miracle of podcasts and earbuds. Earbuds. Buddies for your ears, I suppose. Don't listen too loud. Take care of your hearing. You'll be glad you did, or you'll remember that you did not. We broadcast from KCDZ 107.7 FM in Joshua Tree. Thanks for listening and good night from the voice of the desert.
A big thanks to Ken Lane for his work on Desert Oracle Radio. Thank you, Gallatin Valley, and everyone for listening. Please call and leave me a message or text about anything on your mind. The number is 406-404-6246. You can hear this program on the air at 95.9 FM, Bozeman Community Radio, or you can stream it online at kgvm.org. at 7 p.m. Sunday and 9 a.m. Monday. Our past Desert Oracle Radio replay episodes are also available on demand on the kgvm.org website. Well, till next week, stay well and sweet dreams, and have a really fun Gallatin Valley Earth Day on the 20th, and be nice to our mama.